Shrink Wrap Radio number 29, March 19th, 2006. Mindful Leadership, Mindful Living. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What helps me to be able to not get caught in the content of those kinds of imbalanced emotional responses is that there's a solid core that grew out of both the analytic experience and also grew out of the years of meditating. Because one of the things that I learned very early on, because in my teenage years I was a musician in a folk rock group, is that you have to tune your instrument before you go on stage.
Yeah.
And every day I get up and I meditate, and that's the tuning of my instrument as self.
That was the voice of my good friend, Dr. Ron Alexander, who many years ago was my student and whom I now regard as both colleague and teacher. Since the days when I knew him as a master's student at Sonoma State University, Dr. Alexander has gone on to be a therapist and workshop leader of considerable note, often working with talent in the film and music industries. He also works as a consultant to the media in the Los Angeles and New York City areas. Ron conducts workshops around the U.S. and internationally on topics relating to meditation, spirituality, healing, personal growth, and leadership. And for the purposes of this interview, I was particularly interested in honing in on the work he does around leadership issues. As you could hear in the brief clip, all of his work is rooted in his own longtime practice as a meditator and the learning and growth that came out of his personal psychoanalysis. Let's go to the interview. Dr. Ronald Alexander, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I've been trying to get you on here for some time. You are one of the busiest guys I know, doing therapy, leading workshops around the country and in various parts of the world, coaching business leaders, teaching meditation, working on a book or maybe two books. Tell us what your year looks like. I know I was on your website. I looked at your calendar, and it blew me away. Tell us a little bit about everything that you're doing.
Well, this year is a very exciting year. I'll have the opportunity to start out in April in New York. I'll be going into New York to do a three-day training. It's the end of a 16-month of training on mind-body healing therapies.
Okay.
I've done at the New York Open Center.
Uh-huh.
And then from there I'll head off to a month in Europe where I'll be doing workshops in London and in Dublin. In London, I'll be teaching workshops at the Mind Body Spirit Conference, at the center called Alternatives, another center called the College of Psychic Studies. Then be doing seeing some private clients for coaching sessions, and mind body healing sessions, and then over to Dublin to Jane Stephenson and Associates to do some evening talks and some one-day workshops on mind, mood, and happiness.
Wow. And that's just, what, 2 months' worth that you've given us?
Yeah, that's just April and May.
Okay,
yeah.
That's probably enough for now.
Yeah. Right, I'm tired already just hearing it.
Yeah, and are all your other months similarly busy?
Yeah. Heading into 2007, I'll be going down under again to do training and consulting and coaching in Australia and four or five different of the major gestalt therapy institutes, and just for example, in Sydney and in Lismore, and most likely Perth and Brisbane, and then up to Byron Bay. I'll be doing a private retreat most likely. And I'll also be doing in September with Dr. David Van Eyck.
Aha, yes, we'll be coming
to the program in Tuscany.
Right, and we'll come back to that at the end of the show. Okay. I want to tell people a little bit about what they might expect there if they're able to join us. So you touched on a number of things there. But boy, you're traveling. It reminds me of something I think it was my dad used to say, which was, love the life you live and live the life you love. And it sounds like you're doing that. Now, you mentioned...
Very much so.
Pardon? Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, I feel a bit like the Irish version of Zorba the Greek.
Right. Now, you mentioned Gestalt therapy. You mentioned mind-body healing. What are the subject areas, topics in which you work?
Gestalt therapy is probably the cornerstone to my work, and I first became exposed to that briefly while I was a student at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst in the early 70s, and a fellow that came out from Esalen Institute, John Heider, came to the New England Educational Institute, run by Jack Canfield, popular writer of the Chicken Soup book series.
Right.
And then about 2 years later, when I was a graduate student studying with you and several other people, Eleanor Criswell, Stanley Krippner, we had a workshop with John Heider, I believe, nearby your home, and I was very, very impressed with his skill set, and I found it was much different from what I had previously been exposed to, which was much more along the lines of Rogerian and or psychoanalytic talk therapies. I was very impressed with that it was experiential.
This is John Heider's work you're referring to now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so my own work is influenced very heavily by Gestalt work, and then I had the unique opportunity to study and train with Milton Erickson, the famed master hypnotherapist out in Phoenix, Arizona, and then several of his senior students along the road, Ernest Rossi, Stephen Gilligan.
Yeah, that's quite an impressive lineup. Now, you also studied psychoanalysis, as I recall.
Yeah, in 1983, I went through a period where I was 33, and I'd already finished graduate school, and I was teaching as an adjunct professor in several clinical psychology departments in Los Angeles and adjunctively at UCLA and USC Extension, in both in the departments of psychology, the behavioral sciences, the entertainment and arts department, and the School of Medicine. And I had a very, very successful, within 5 years, I started my private practice in 1976 in Beverly Hills, and then I moved over to West Hollywood to the Cedars-Sinai West Medical Tower, was involved in the beginning of one of the very first holistic and integrated medical centers in the United States, and it was called the Center for Health and Healing. And while I was involved there, I had the unique opportunity in just the very first year to start working with a screenwriter who was also an executive producer for a television show at Universal. And as I worked with him, and he had run into creative and writer's block, and he'd been promoted from a staff writer. He'd spent for the most part of his career really struggling to come up the ranks, and he'd finally gotten a staff writing job and was making good money, and then he was appointed the producer of this very successful television show, and then he froze and So he was referred by his doctor to me. And so we did a series of both meditation and mind-body healing sessions, which involved hypnosis and some Gestalt therapy work. And I suggested that he visualize himself as a violinist who had a frozen shoulder. And I had him stand up in the room and had him stand on both of his legs and bend his knees and had him start playing an imaginary violin as if the violin was his pen. And I mean, the handle of the violin was his pen, and the violin itself was the paper.
Okay.
And he went to kind of, and I had him make the sounds of the violin vocally, and then he went through 10 or 15 minutes of doing this, and he burst out laughing, and he got filled with a lot of joy, and he felt a lot of energy flow through his body. Then he left the session, and then he called up a couple of days later and said that he spontaneously had waken up in the middle of the night after having a series of dreams, and he was writing very fluidly and openly. And so then shortly after that, he started to send in a lot of his colleagues, directors, writer friends. He was involved in a leaderless men's group of noted Hollywood writers, producers, directors, development execs. So then one, that one patient led to a whole series of patients, and then various studios such as Universal and Sony and the Disney division, which is called WED, which is the Division of Creative Imagineering, hired me to come and to work with both individuals and various departments to consult on creativity and stress management and the creative process.
Well, that all sounds great. Now, I think either you didn't hear my question or you forgot it, which was that you had some involvement with psychoanalysis.
Oh, right. Yeah. I don't.
Is this resistance?
What's that?
I say, is this resistance that we're hearing, not wanting to talk about your experience with psychoanalysis?
Yeah, this is classic psychoanalytic resistance, actually, because what it has to do with, and what I immediately thought of, as soon as you answered the question, is I thought of those two periods of time in my life, which was I had enormous and creative success, but I was 32 or 33 years old, and I felt enormously depressed.
Uh-huh.
So I was living in my dream house in Laurel Canyon. I had all the money that a young person at that time could want. I had wonderful clients and job opportunities, and I had this overwhelming sense of dread and depressive anxiety. So I decided that I would do something that was outside of my own training that I had spoken to several friends and colleagues about, which was to undertake the psychoanalytic process of going to see an analyst 3 days a week, laying down on the couch, and the analyst really didn't say much. And so then I spent 6 years in analysis and then probably a total of 10 to 12 years getting training and supervision in the psychoanalytic process.
Interesting.
Which is an extremely formative and very useful component of my training, even though I don't see myself as an analyst or someone who primary focus is psychoanalytic. I certainly do retain the roots and the deep heritage, both from the Freudian psychoanalytic vantage point as well as the British object relation school. And then, of course, I've always been deeply influenced by the Jungian analytic process.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I know that when we've worked together in workshops over the past 4 years, you've made reference to having spent a ton of money on psychoanalysis, but it seems like it was money well spent.
Yeah, it was very expensive, and certainly there's probably some more efficient ways and cost-efficient and less expensive therapeutic modalities to get similar results from, but it certainly was an extremely important and essential part of my background.
Okay, shifting focus just a little, I know that you've been very involved in spiritual practice the whole time I've known you. Do I recall correctly that you spent some time in India?
Yeah, I've actually spent had many trips to India, and interestingly enough, my earliest in original involvement with spiritual practices came about in more of a Krishnamurti model, which was I picked up a book by Krishnamurti where he was saying you don't need a guru.
Mm-hmm.
You can be your own teacher. And I started studying Alan Watts because when I was a student at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, we brought Alan out to speak at Amherst College. And one of the things that Alan was saying is that you can be your own guru.
Yeah.
And you can become your own teacher. So when I first started studying Buddhism, as a result of Alan Watts' influence, and then I was able to minor at Smith College in Buddhist studies and under the tutelage of Professor Emeritus Tai Uno, who is still in the Northampton area. At the time, he was the chair of the Buddhist Studies Department at Smith.
Okay.
You know, although the courses were very theoretical on Buddhism, he also made some of them experiential, and then he would bring in various teachers like Swami Satchidananda, Yogi Bhajan, Sasaki Roshi, T.D. Suzuki, and many other, Allen Ginsberg, Choyum Kupa Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan teacher.
Right, right. Now, later you became an ordained Buddhist monk, right? How did that come about?
I was studying Zen from 1973. And then in the late, mid-90s, I've been studying every summer at the Tassara Zen Center in Carmel Valley. And very influenced by Suzuki Roshi,
mm-hmm.
you know, author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Right, right. I love that book.
Yeah, just wonderful. It starts with the wonderful quote, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few. And
yeah.
So Zen really is the bedrock of the foundation of a lot of my spiritual background, but I also have had a very diverse spiritual studies. And so in the mid-90s, I began working with the Zen priest, Ed Brown, from the San Francisco Zen Center. And we decided that it was time, after some 25 years of study, for me to take the Zen precepts, which is called the Jaiku ordination. And so I did, and that was around in 1999. And then prior to that, I'd spent time studying Vipassana meditation in India and in Sri Lanka, and Tibetan Buddhist meditation, both here in the United States and also in Nepal under the advanced Dzogchen master, Soki Rinpoche, who was one of the two sons. His other brother is Choki Nima Rinpoche. That's the older brother, and Sokni is the younger brother. And they're both, and there's a third brother. They're the children of the late Tukul Ugun Rinpoche, who was the esteemed Dzogchen master out of Nepal, and they all escaped from Tibet around the time the Dalai Lama did. And Tukul Ugun Rinpoche recently has been reincarnated. And recently got an email off the web that they found him somewhere. They found him living in the United States, of all places. And so they just sent a photograph of him this morning.
Wow. There must be a lot of excitement in the Tibetan Buddhist community around that.
Yes, huge excitement because he was an extraordinary Dzogchen master that many of the senior, both American students and Asian students, were studying with for many years, including Dan Goleman and his wife Tara Bennett Goleman, Roger Walsh, people of that stature.
Yeah, yeah.
The late Francesco Viella. He was the head of the Louis Pasteur Institute in Paris, France, who was a neuroscientist as well as a Buddhist meditation practitioner.
Mm-hmm. So how has your own experience in analysis and your practice as a meditator informed the work that you're doing today?
It's a really good question. I think analysis was extremely helpful to create the capacity of what's called in the meditation practices self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And then from both Zen and from Vipassana, it helped to build an internal structure at being able to observe, view, and study the mind-body process. And so it's really enabled me to build both a solid and cohesive core sense of self, and at the same time to develop what we call Gurdjieff in his teachings to his senior student Uspensky called the witness, and what we call in Buddhist mind the observing mind, and in ego psychology it's often called the observing or the objective ego. And I think having that is a primary fundamental core in how I view things, that there's a me that's always present and is involved in quieting and slowing things down so that I can listen to and see my clients and the people that I teach as if I was looking through fresh eyes and ears. So almost as if I'm looking or listening through, you know, the third ear of, mm-hmm. of the third set of eyes.
Now, these might all just sound like empty words to our listeners, but I've worked with you now in, you know, in these groups that we've been doing together and had an opportunity to observe your work over the years, and I've just marveled at how present you are and your skill in working with people. And I know that when I asked you, that's where this question came from, a little bit of a setup, because I know I asked you, Ron, how did you get to be as good as you are? And you told me it's from meditation, at least that was a real important part in terms of really being able to... I liked what you said about that the analysis helped you to form a strong central part of yourself that is the place in which you can stand. It sounds like both analysis and meditation have had that effect. So that you can, I've heard you sort of stay very centered as you're being buffeted by perhaps, you know, whether the person's in resistance or they're criticizing you or whatever. You're able to kind of hold that center and come from that place and not come back from reactive anger.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate your acknowledgement of that. And to coin one of your terms, when one of our clients in one of our retreats was throwing all of her toys out the window one night on the way to a restaurant and came back, and there was a kind of a fierce exchange of anger on her part because she was in some kind of projection. What helps me to be able to not get caught in the content of those kinds of imbalanced emotional responses is that there's a solid core that grew out of both the analytic experience and also grew out of the years of meditating. Because one of the things that I learned very early on, because in my teenage years I was a musician in a folk rock group, is that you have to tune your instrument before you go on stage.
Yeah.
And every day I get up and I meditate. And that's the tuning of my instrument as self.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of my mentors or teachers along the way, the late Robert Martin, who was a very esteemed Gestalt therapist, but he was also, he was from L.A. and then he moved up to Portland, Oregon, died about 10 years ago, but he was also an artist and a painter and sculptress. And he said it was very important that any artist take a certain amount of time each day before that they begin their art form to just sit quietly and be with themselves. And of course, that's something that I learned early on from Sasaki Roshi and Suzuki Roshi. So you really have to tune your own instrument.
Yeah, I love that metaphor of tuning the instrument. You know, a lot of people wonder, well, what's the purpose of meditating? And I think you've given a good motivation, a good rationale for why it's worth spending the time in that practice. Let me move it even a step closer towards the personal. We all face personal crises. Can you think of a personal crisis where either your psychological or your spiritual learning pulled you through?
Yeah. In 1985, I underwent a really severe period of depression and self-doubt. And I had recently gotten divorced, and I ended a relationship with a German woman whom I think you even remember meeting up in San Francisco. And there were a lot of very extremely dark, cloudy days where I would wake up in the morning and there was a real deep sense of existential dread. After all the years of spiritual training and meditation, the sense of existential dread and loneliness and isolation and depression over being alone after, you know, a 7-year marriage and then a 3-year relationship really left me dislocated from myself and really questioning everything. Here I was, 35, and I had all the money and all the personal kinds of effects that are supposed to make you happy, and I had professional success, and I was running at that time in my life with what we would call the Hollywood and music crowd, and it was very exciting, and in a lifetime, you know, sitting in on dress rehearsals with Don Henley and Fleetwood Mac and bands like that.
Yeah.
And yet, I remember going through this long period of about 18 months of really deeply feeling depressed and questioning everything, questioning whether I even wanted to stay on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And the anchor, or the rudder, because the ship clearly was taking a lot of water in those days.
Yeah.
It had a lot of depressive water in it.
Right.
And I was never somebody who would like hit like alcohol or drugs to temper it.
Yeah.
And so because I started meditating after I had some experiments with drugs between 20 and 22, and then I became a vegetarian and got involved in Kundalini yoga and Tibetan Buddhism and Zen. So I really didn't have much to temper or buffer or anesthetize the pain at that time. And so I was really taking a lot of water. The ship itself was really starting to feel like it was going under.
Yeah.
And one night I dreamt. I had this dream, and being very Jungian, psychologically influenced, I had a dream that the ship was starting to, one side of the left side was starting to fill up with water, and the ship was tilting.
So you had an actual dream about a ship?
Yeah, I actually dreamt about a ship.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was a metaphor you were using now, but that, and it's a great metaphor, but the metaphor came to you in a dream.
It came to me in a dream one night, and it was sort of like, you know, when a ship lists, they call it, to the left side.
Sure.
And on the far right side of the front part of a ship, I guess, is the bow.
Yeah.
Was a little yogi meditating. Who looked like a Buddhist monk. And so I woke up that morning and I thought, that's it. That's a sign, a signal to start meditating and meditating more frequently. in addition to continuing to go through my analysis. And something dramatic and remarkable started to shift, and even my analyst noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, I told her about the dream, and she said, well, she wasn't very mystical or spiritually educated, so she didn't really understand, you know, why that would be significant. But she left that up to me to explain it to her. And then I started meditating 2 to 3 times a day. And within a short couple of weeks and a couple of months, I started experiencing a lot of vitality and creativity, and I started reading and working on some papers that I had put off. And it was the importance of this, of relying and drawing back on the spiritual disciplines. Using the Asian model to help balance out some of the psychological and emotional pain and suffering.
Hey, thanks for sharing that. I think other people might be able to take some hints or some strength from it. There's so many different areas that you work in, and boy, we could just go on, and I would love to. One of the things that I had really intended for us to hone in on is leadership, because I know you do all these workshops on leadership. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that. What's the theoretical underpinning that you draw upon in those leadership workshops?
Well, the primary theoretical model that I'm drawing on, and I'm also the second book, I have to take it one at a time, but I'm already starting to do what many writers do, which is that while you're working on your first book, you're thinking of your second. It's going to be called The Mindful Leader.
Okay.
And it's really applying mindfulness meditation and the essence of Gestalt therapy, of leading from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really emphasize that in a model of leadership, that a leader has to lead his or herself first and foremost, and that it's important to lead from a model of that you grow people like a garden, and a good leader wants to grow really strong and really healthy trees and flowers and fruit. And in order to do that, the leader has to have the vision,
mm-hmm.
and has to be out in front of his or her vision, pulling all of the people that they're leading towards that vision, and so that there's an emphasis on collaboration and team effort, and there's also an emphasis on positive and unconditional self-regard. The leader has to have positive and unconditional regard for his or her own self, and then for the selves of the people that they're leading and growing. And that what's first and foremost is not the bottom line. The bottom line is not to be negated, because we certainly live in a world, in the business world, where many of the companies I consult to, we'll just take the music industry. A lot of the young guys that I consult with out of L.A. and the New York offices who are in promotion, the bottom line is they got to get their records on the radio station, and they got to get airplay, and they got to produce a certain amount of bottom line sales. But what I emphasize is it's the process of how you go about interacting with people in a conscious way, consciously communicating, being conscious and aware that you're growing people. And first and foremost, what grows people is how you communicate. And so I have a model where I talk about managing down, managing across, and managing up. And without getting into the technical or theoretical aspects of that in this interview, what needs to be essential and primary is that you're interacting with people and seeing them as opportunities and beings who have great capability and possess great potential.
Mm-hmm.
And then each and every interaction every day is that the mindful leader is looking in the same way that a parent is growing a child to become all that they can be.
Yeah.
That a mindful leader really is growing people's potential through the job challenge. And so in that model, mindful leader is really playing in what I call the consciousness game, or consciously doing business, mm-hmm. rather than that business is doing them.
Right, right. Hey, this is going to be a great book. I look forward to reading it. When did you first know you wanted to be a psychologist?
I was in my junior year at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. My first 2 years, I majored in business administration and at the community college, and thought I was going to get an MBA. And then in my junior year, I transferred to UMass Amherst, and I started to study Tai Chi. And I took a class on death and dying with the late Teresina Havens, who was a Buddhist studies professor. She was at Yale, and then she was at Smith, and then she came to UMass Amherst, and her husband, and they were both Quakers and Zen Buddhists, and his name was Joseph Haydens, and he was a very renowned Quaker religious psychologist. He published a lot of papers on religion and psychology, and he had studied with a religious psychologist in Los Angeles, very close to the community I now live in the Santa Monica Canyon, by the man's name was Fritz Kunkel, and they were all very close with Alan Watts and Christopher Isherwood in that whole early 40s and 50s existential revival of interest in Zen and an existential philosopher. They hung out with Henry Miller, Annalise Nin. And so I met these folks very early on in my junior year, and just started to have a natural affinity for wanting to, like a thirst or a hunger that was uncontrollable, to mm-hmm. read everything I could. The very first book I read was on was Herbert Fingeret's book, The Self and Transformation, which is really, it's a book about mysticism and psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. and it just completely, I couldn't stop reading, like day and night, and it just opened up, almost like exploded inside of me, a whole new interest in a world of personal growth and of the psychology of emotions and of mysticism. And then I came upon the Krishnamurti book, and then the third book was the autobiography of a yogi by Yogananda.
Yeah. Well, to round this off, you know, you're talking about books. I wonder if there is a book or two that you would recommend to our listeners that they might want to read today if they're looking to be ignited.
There's so many great books out there. There's The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, mm-hmm. which I think is wonderful. There's Freedom from the Known by Krishnamurti. And there's Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind,
yeah,
which I think is really wonderful. And then Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche's book, The Myth of Freedom and Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which I think are wonderful. And then a classic book, yeah. that I discovered at Amherst and then continued to read and reread while I was a student with you at Sonoma State University, was Carl Jung's famed book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections.
Yeah.
I think that's just so rich.
Right.
And it can really seed in anyone the garden of self-discovery.
Nicely put. Okay, well, why don't we close with you giving a little promo for the workshop that you and I will be doing in Tuscany in the fall.
Okay. September 16th to the 23rd, September 18th to the 24th, at the EBBIO Retreat Center. It's a beautiful retreat center north of Rome in Tuscany. It's an old ancient villa that's been restored, and beautiful olive tree landscaping. It's a Tuscan villa, and it's right near an old ancient volcano, so it has an old shamanic energy connected to it. And David and I are going to spend the week with a group of people, and mornings usually are devoted to first part is meditation, and then we do mind-body healing work in group process, where we work with dreams and people's individual psychological, emotional issues. And then afternoons usually are free to go hiking and wandering in the countryside. And then we meet again before dinner, about 5 to 7:30, and then we do more meditation work and from Buddhist perspectives, as well as the non-dual orientation, which is more Vedic and Hindu. And then we continue to work with the group and individuals in the group. And we'll do that for 5 or 6 days and finish up on Saturday evening. And if you want more information on that, you just go to www.ronaldalexander.com. www.ronaldalexander.com, and on the website look under trainings and workshop schedule, and there's a direct link, and there's information about David, Dan Ives, and myself as the leaders, and it's a more detailed description. And then you can write to info@ronaldalexander.com, and office assistant Rhonda will send you a more detailed description of fees and dates and how to get there and travel arrangements.
Hey, Ron, it sounds good to me. I think I'll go there and attend.
Yeah, well, you'll be co-leading, which is exciting. And I just put you, I wrote about you in the book this morning, the book on the alchemy of change.
Oh, great.
Last year while we were in Switzerland, you made the suggestion to have one of the group members, I thought he needed attention, that he needed to tell people that he needed attention, and you suggested that we get people to give him attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote about that suggestion, and then his involvement with telling us the story about that as a little boy, he wrote a story of a talk show that was hosted by a snake to all the animals in the jungle. Remember that one?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Hey, well, I'm going to let you get back to working on that book. I know I kind of interrupted your writing morning. Hey, thanks so much for being a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. You can consider yourself shrunk and wrapped.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Ron's family background is Boston Irish, and he's retained that Boston accent over all these years, and I always get a big kick out of it. A lot of people who profess to be, quote, spiritual can be stuffy and sanctimonious. Ron is neither of these. He's unpretentious, he's self-disclosing, and just plain fun to hang out with. He's got a wonderful sense of humor, which I hope came through at least a little bit in the interview. When we do therapeutic work in the groups we co-lead, I'm always extremely impressed by his laser-like attention. He's able to listen with very focused attention to the person who is working and to track both the details of their story and the emotional shifts as they move through their work. My own belief is that just being on the receiving end of that kind of attention is healing in and of itself. When I've asked Ron how he got to be such a good therapist, he's given the credit to years of meditation. What I've witnessed in terms of Ron's skill as a therapist is the best advertisement for the regular practice of meditation that I've ever seen. The other ingredient to Ron's success, aside from substantial natural gifts of intelligence, energy, enthusiasm, and humor, is the fact that he has always gone out of his way to study with the best teachers and mentors he could find. Another hallmark of Ron's work is his abundant use of metaphor. In part, this was probably inspired by his study with Milton Erickson, the granddaddy of hypnotherapy. During one of the breaks in our workshop in Mallorca a couple of years ago, Ron was questioning my decision to retire from a plum academic job. I was still having some doubts if I had made the right decision. When I explained my rationale for choosing the retirement option that I did, which included a 2-year service bonus, he said, "Oh, so what you did is you grabbed the golden fruit." The way he delivered the line and the metaphorical acknowledgement of the wisdom of my choice was delightful and perfect, and I've hung on to the knowledge that I did indeed grab the golden fruit, and I haven't looked back in regret since. I feel very blessed to have Ron in my life, and I'm glad to have had this opportunity to share him with you. I hope you can join us in Tuscany. Before we dip into the mailbag, I want to share a special offer with you. As part of the Pod Show Delivery Network, we're participating in a promotion for GoDaddy.com. They're the number one domain registrar worldwide. They also do web hosting, domain name transfers, and they have some free blogging software that you might be interested in. As a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio, you qualify for dramatic discounts on their already low prices. You'll find the details on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Speaking of blogs, my good friend Jerry Trumbull, who is featured on a couple of our early episodes, called my attention to a very positive mention of Shrink Wrap Radio on a blog by Nathaniel Jacobson. And on his blog, which is called Net, he mentioned his favorite podcasts, most of which are produced by commercial entities. So I was quite flattered to find Shrink Wrap Radio mentioned there. Nathaniel, thanks, and I hope you're still listening. If so, drop a line. Next, we have emails, two emails actually, from Canadian listeners. The first says, "Dear Dr. David, the purpose of this email is twofold. Firstly, I'd like to express my great appreciation for your Shrink Wrap Radio. I am an avid listener of your podcast and find the topics you cover to be varied, thought-provoking, and a very welcome breath of intellectual fresh air in the podosphere. Incidentally, I believe I found your podcast via a promo played on Adam Curry's Daily Source Code." Great, I'm glad to hear it. I thought I would get a lot more from that promo than evidently showed up, so I'm glad it got through to somebody. "Secondly," she says, "I'd like to be so bold as to suggest a possible future topic for Shrink Wrap Radio, the use of art as a therapeutic tool. Perhaps you could interview an art therapist. I believe that a number of your podcast listeners would benefit from this information and or experience, be they professionally trained artists, hobbyists, or simply people who might find throwing some paint around to be hugely cathartic. Let me give you the backstory. I'm a professional visual artist living and working in Toronto, Canada. No, I'm not an art therapist, but I have used my art to work through issues I have stemming from childhood abuse. I've not entered upon this under the guidance of a therapist, but have embarked upon this journey myself. It will perhaps come as no surprise to you that I found this therapy to be fruitful, both aesthetically as well as psychologically. I don't have a podcast, but I do have a website that features my work." Let's see, I'm not going to give that website address since I've shared something fairly personal here. There are two series that I have created that directly address my history as a survivor, and she goes on to name those. She says, "My current work addresses the topic of motherhood, which incidentally may be the reason that this email seems somewhat choppy. My little son still doesn't sleep through the night. Keep up the good work. From a sleep-deprived Canadian fan, best regards." And she signs her name, but since I didn't get permission to read this, I'm going to withhold the name. Then I hear from another Canadian listener who says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to..." Oh, by the way, before I go into this next one, let me just respond to the earlier one. "Hey, you're reading my mind in regard to having an art therapist on. It turns out that our last guest, not today's, but the one from before, Dr. Craig Chalquist, I asked him if he had any good suggestions for a guest. he gave me the name of an art therapist. And that was before I received this email. In addition, I know some other very good art therapists myself. So I was definitely planning to have a show featuring an art therapist sometime quite soon. Okay, now back to the second letter. Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to drop a quick note to let you know I'm one of those from the wider audience who's listening. It's March break here on the east coast of Canada, and my family and I went to a resort for a couple of days of R&R. The ride was a good 2 hours, and while they slept quietly en route, I listened to all the back issues I've missed from Shrink Wrap. I've really enjoyed the eclectic nature of your broadcasts. I'd have to say some of my favorite episodes were on the hero's journey, NLP, aging, and dreams. I used to keep a dream journal, and it's still by my bed. I guess it's time for me to get in touch with my inner hero and do a little NLP to make it a habit again before I get too old. In my weekly podcast, The Sonic Society, I understand the joy, as you do, in meeting like-minded individuals and getting the opportunity to let them share their unique voice with the internet. As a writer, I'm most interested in the choices we make as characters, both through the conscious and the subconscious. In fact, I'm considering writing a book on character, gleaning some of the best things I know about making characters and stories. It's interesting to me that doing so is a study in and of itself in psychology. Keep up the good work and stay tuned, Jack. And he gives his full name, Jack Ward, host of the Sonic Society. So thanks very much for that, Jack. I went online, I went to iTunes, and I typed in Sonic Society, did a search, and found the show, and I listened to your most recent one, or at least I started it. I particularly liked your lead-in and the way you set the whole story up. So I recommend Sonic Society to any listeners who are interested in radio dramas, like in the old days. Only these are not old-time radio dramas. I think they're actually currently written dramas, you know, freshly written dramas, especially for this medium. Jack and I exchanged a couple more emails, and I found out that not only does he have a podcast, but in fact, his shows are distributed across Canadian radio networks. Okay, that's it for the mail. Now for a couple of announcements. I've mentioned that I'm going to be conducting a weekend workshop in Ireland in the early part of May, and I'm wondering if I have any Irish listeners lurking out there. If so, I'd love to hear from you, and perhaps we could have a visit when I'm in your country. Next, I want to let you know about the next two episodes that are coming up. I'm very excited about both. Next week's interview will be with Dr. Stanley Krippner. You might have heard Ron Alexander's passing reference to him as one of his important teachers. Among other things, Stanley Krippner is probably the world's foremost scientific parapsychologist. Whether you are a believer in ESP and such or not, I think you'll find this to be a fascinating interview. The week following that, I hope to feature Dr. Alberto Violdo. Like Ron Alexander, Alberto was one of my students in that same distant past, and he also studied with Stanley Krippner and co-wrote a book with him. And like Ron, he's gone on to considerable fame and fortune as the leading author and workshop leader on shamanism. We love hearing from listeners. Please send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Our show notes are at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemail for ShrinkPod on Skype or Gizmo Project. And as I mentioned, we have a phone in the U.S. where you can leave voicemail, and that number is 206-888-2746. Okay, stay tuned after our closing theme music to hear not one, but two PodSafe music selections from India in honor of today's guest, Dr. Ron Alexander. The first is titled Om Namah Shivaya by Bombay musician Pranav Chavda. The second is Silk Root by Satya. You'll find links in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shivaya.